From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Nicholas Carr's latest book is about how computers and software have come to do the things we used to do ourselves, like find something on a map, or look up the spelling of a word, or assemble a car in a factory, find a constellation, mow the lawn. That's where we are. Anyway, that's where we're headed. We consult screens, we take advice from digital voices, and let's face it, it makes our lives easier, even safer. But Carr's book is about the human consequences of automation. He's joining us to explain what he sees as the deeper, hidden effects of automation, how it can narrow our perspective, limit our choices, and he says, take a toll on our work, our talent, our lives. His book is called The Glass Cage. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Some of the reaction to Nicholas Carr's book about the human consequences of computer automation has been a little hysterical. It's been called an anti-technology rant, paranoid. He's been referred to as a Luddite. But throughout the book, Carr makes the point again and again, automation is not bad, not necessarily. The point, he says, is that we humans are not very good at thinking rationally about automation or understanding the implications of automation. And even though he worries that it may be eroding our skills and stripping out the joy of work, Carr is not proposing to halt the march of technology or limit the innovations of automation. But this is what he's trying to do with the book. Here's what he writes. To resist invention is not to reject invention. It's to humble invention, to bring progress back down to earth. His book is called The Glass Cage, Automation and Us. Nicholas Carr writes about technology and culture. His books include The Big Switch and The Shallows, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. And he's joining us today from KGNU in Boulder, Colorado. And Nicholas Carr, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, we're going to explore this in greater detail a little bit later on the program, but I wanted to start here because you say in the book that there's this one line of verse, actually from Robert Frost, that you kept going back to as you were writing this book. It's this line, "The fact is the sweetest dream that labor knows." Explain why you kept coming back to that and what it says about what you're trying to get at in the book.
Well, that's a line from a sonnet Robert Frost wrote around 1900 or very early in that century. And I first read the poem, which is called Mowing, when I was in college, which is quite a long time ago now. And it's kind of haunted me ever since because it's a beautiful evocation, the entire poem, of how working, doing some, making some effort in the world, in this case, cutting a field for hay, involves us more in the world and opens up the world and opens up experience to us in a way that being idle or being at leisure doesn't. And that particular line, "the fact is the sweetest dream that labor knows," is the second to last line in the poem. Mm. And it's always been kind of mysterious to me, because it is a mysterious line. But as I was writing this book, which is very much about how we decide what we're going to do for ourselves and versus what we're going to give to a machine or to, in this case, a computer, that does shape our experience of life. And so the poem became clearer to me as I wrote the book and kind of its thrust as well. So I felt compelled to kind of end it with a discussion of that poem.
Yeah. We'll come back to it. There's this story you tell early on in the book that turns out to provide a pretty good metaphor for the ideas in the book. It's about you figuring out how to drive a stick shift.
Right.
to talk about that, because I think there's another bit of work or a bit of effort that you have to go through. Tell that story if you would.
Well, When I took driver's education through my high school, I learned on an automatic, which, you know, learning to drive is difficult, but an automatic transmission makes it much easier. But then the only car available to me at home was a manual transmission. And so I had no choice but to drive that. And my dad gave me kind of a very cursory introduction to how you shift and where the gears are and, you know, basic speed ranges and stuff. But then I had to learn on the job, so to speak, which was quite embarrassing often when you'd stall out on a hill and begin to drift backwards and tap the bumper of the car behind you. But eventually, you know, after a week or two of embarrassment and cringing whenever I'd have to go driving, I got a handle on it. And soon, it became second nature, which is, as you say, a metaphor for kind of how we master any skill in the world. But I kind of yearned for an automatic. One reason was that they seemed more modern. It was like, you know, the difference between having a dishwasher and washing dishes by hand. And eventually I got an automatic. And at first it seemed great, you know, oh, the machine is doing this little bit of work for me, and now I can be a little bit more leisurely in driving or whatever. But then I realized I kind of missed the manual, that I yearned to have this effort relieved or taken out of my life. And then I felt a little less engaged with driving, a little more like a passenger and less like a driver. And so it gave me a little lesson that, you know, be careful what you wish for when it comes to offloading work and effort to technology.
Yeah. Do you worry? I mentioned some of the reaction to your book. I don't want to overstate that people are freaking out about it or anything like that. But I do. You must be a little worried that people are oversimplifying it. That seems to be my reaction, and not really getting what you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, I do have to say that there have been some very good reviews
as well. Of course,
But yeah, no, you're right that it's frustrating. What I really tried to do with this book is kind of get into the subtleties of automation, get into the subtleties of our use of and dependence on computers, and kind of try to get across that we shouldn't just think of, you know, there's work that we do by ourselves, and then there's automation, and that's the process. Automation is about constantly making new decisions, and the decisions are made by the designers of the software or the system and by the people who use them. But this series of decisions about how we divide work, how we divide effort. And as computers progress, we have to remake those decisions constantly. And so the point isn't that we should go back, you know, to some mythical time where we did everything ourselves. The point is that we need to be very careful and very alert and very wise about how we divide these tasks, because they do. They not only have practical consequences for safety and efficiency and so forth, but they have more philosophic or experiential consequences. They shape the way we live, and we should recognize that and be careful about it.
You say in the book, technology has always challenged people to think about what's important in their lives, to really ask themselves what human being means. What do you mean by that?
Human beings are tool makers and tool users, and we always have been. Yeah. And it's one of it's not only something that distinguishes us from other animals, it's a great benefit to us in general that when we make a tool, whether it's a microscope or a hammer or whatever, we expand what we can do. We expand our talents and hence enrich our experience of life, make the world more interesting. The more you can do in the world, the more interesting it becomes. But then there's also the reverse effect that if you give away too much effort, if you begin to put a computer screen between you and everything you do, then you're not enriching your experience. You're impoverishing it. You're putting distance between you in the world. You're reducing your talents. You're reducing your perceptions. And so I think one way to think about technology is that our use of it and the way we design it is kind of this constant process of negotiating the terms of our engagement with the world, the terms of our experience. So it very much is tied into the experience of being a human being inside the world of nature, inside the world of culture and society. And so that's what I was trying to get across there, I think.
You say that, this surprised me, the word automation really didn't come into the language until, but wasn't so long ago. What was it, 1946?
46. And that's because automation, what we today refer to as automation, which is the use of computers or electronic controls to govern the operation of a machine of some sort. That was really only became possible through through inventions that were made during the Second World War, and in particular the invention of a much more automated anti-aircraft gun, and this was a great achievement because the Nazis were bombing Great Britain and there was this huge need obviously for accurate anti-aircraft fire, and so a whole team of very talented scientists developed this automated weapon that kind of took in signals from radar and made projections about where a bomber would be in the future, not where it was at the moment, and then fired the gun. And so this, after the war was over, this capability of having machines that some way can sense the environment and then through a complicated feedback process govern their own operations, moved into factories. And that's when that's when the word automation was coined. It was coined in a Ford motor plant.
And it didn't take long for us to worry about what that meant. There's another book you refer to from 1956, Automation, Friend or Foe. So I guess we always fret about this stuff, I suppose.
We do, and in fact, and this surprised me in doing the research, in the 50s, automation, just as it's becoming today, was a very big point of debate, and there was a great deal of both optimism and even utopian thinking about, now that machines can operate themselves and we have computers, we'll get rid of work altogether and we'll live these glorious lives of leisure, and then there was also a great deal of fear that automation was going to destroy our jobs and that ultimately it might turn us in, as we became dependent on computers and robots, it would kind of turn us into computers and robots. So we've struggled with this, and I think you can even go back to mechanization before that in the 200 years ago with the Industrial Revolution. We've wrestled with this challenge of using machinery and technology wisely for a very, very long time, and we're wrestling with it again.
Yeah, we've always embraced it, as you said. There was this utopian view of it. There was this sense that it was going to transform the work landscape, which obviously it had. You mentioned Adam Smith praised machines, very pretty machines, as he called them. So it was a lot sometimes about labor, about saving labor, but you identify one of the problems of automation as giving us what we don't need at the cost of what we do. In the sense, there's this term, this paradox of work that you describe in the book, and I wanted you to talk about that, if you would.
Back in the, I think it was in the 1980s, a couple of researchers, a couple of professors at University of Chicago went out and did this extensive study of people's experience of their life, their kind of moment by moment, hour to hour experience of being alive. And what they did is they got a bunch of people who worked in lots of different jobs, and they tracked them. Basically, they had little beepers. This was before cell phones were cheap. They had little beepers, the people, and they went off a number of times during the day, and then they had to write down what they were doing, how they felt, what skills were involved and so forth. And they found this paradox, the researchers, that when people were at work, they didn't want to be at work. They wanted to, get off the clock, get out of the job and have their leisure time. And then when they were at leisure, the last thing they wanted was to go back to work. But it turns out that they were much happier and felt much more fulfilled and much more satisfied when they were at work. Mm-hmm. So it's this phenomenon that's sometimes referred to as miswanting.
Right.
We think we want our lives to be easy and to not have to do anything and to have and to be relieved of all effort, but it's actually the effort, the facing challenges and exercising our talents and building our talents that is really what's most pleasurable and most fulfilling in our lives.
Mm. Let's define our terms here. There are two basic types of knowledge, as you write about in the book. There's tacit knowledge and there's explicit knowledge. Explain the difference.
Explicit knowledge is the stuff that you can write down. You can give instructions for. So, you know, how to bake muffins. You can have a recipe that says, you know, do this, and then probably the muffins will come out well. In tacit knowledge is stuff we learn and can do, but we can't really reduce it to a set of instructions or to a recipe. So if you want to tell somebody how to catch a fly ball, for instance, or catch a frisbee, you can show them, but you can't give them instructions and then expect them to master it.
Right.
And so in tacit knowledge is something that we learn through experience, through practicing things, and it becomes an almost unconscious instinct or intuition or skill. And for a long time, it was thought
artistic and creative skills. This comes from, it's a tacit knowledge too, right?
Yes. Yeah. Anything that you do without being able to say, well, here's exactly how I do it.
Yeah. And you say that we've always assumed, there's been this assumption that computers had explicit knowledge and humans had tacit knowledge, that computers weren't very good at the whole tacit knowledge thing. But one of the points of your book is that line is starting to get kind of blurry.
Yeah, until recently, because computers only do what they're programmed to do. So,
right.
So computers are absolutely dependent on following instructions. So we assumed that, you know, they'd be good at things that you could write down the recipe, you could write down the algorithm, as we say. But, you know, how would you get them to display things that we think of as being kind of intuitive? And until very recently, if you looked at discussions of, you know, what will computers be able to do and what will be left to people, it broke down along the line of explicit skills and tacit skills.
Yeah.
And so a classic one was, you know, it's a computer won't be able to drive a car because who knows exactly how we maneuver through traffic or take a left turn through traffic. That seems to be intuitive, and you just won't be able to script that incredibly what seems to be an incredibly complex skill that's done unconsciously in large part. You won't be able to script a computer to do that.
But that's not the case anymore.
but
I mean, so we, I mean, we're, and we're evolving pretty quickly. I mean, that's another point in the book that you talk about is that we're not progressing. Human technology is progressing faster than we can kind of. I this is sort of what I'm getting at from the book. Technology is progressing faster than we can really get it. As human beings, is that fair to say?
I mean, we have a set of skills that have developed through millennia, through thousands and millions of years, physical skills and mental skills, and those change, those evolve very, very slowly. But we've created this technology, the technology of the computer, where the skills seem to be exploding. Mm-hmm. You know, cars now can drive in traffic, at least to a degree, not totally. They can diagnose. I mean, computers can diagnose diseases to an extent, and they can answer these questions about judgment. And so we're kind of, one of the dangers here is we can start to feel like we're stagnant, and maybe since these things are progressing so quickly, maybe we should just defer to them and hand over everything possible to computers. And yet still, what that overlooks is the fact that there are still a whole lot of very subtle, very interesting, very valuable things that we can do that computers can't, and there's no sign that in the immediate future computers will be able to do all of those things.
Well, and one of the big themes of the book is that we're going to have to adapt our own work and our own behavior to technology, to automation, not the other way around, right? I mean, the idea is to make machines adapt to us, or at least impose ourselves, the human factor, which we'll talk about, into the circuitry, I guess.
I think if you assume, as I do, that we will continue, that automation will largely, particularly when you get to complicated things, automation will involve both people and computers, then it becomes imperative that you think of it in those terms. You don't think of it as just, well, what can the computer do, and let's let the computer do it, and then the person becomes this kind of afterthought that has to do certain things that computers can't do yet. You have to, I think, what's imperative for us is to think about the system as having both a human part and a machine part, and make sure that we get the best out of both of those sides, that we don't simply turn the person into a subservient computer operator. We make sure that the person is involved and engaged and enjoying the work, and also building and sustaining their talents, because they're still essential. We're still essential.
Nicholas Carr, his latest book is called The Glass Cage, Automation and Us. Take a quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. Thank you. We are. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about what it means to live in a world where most everything is automated. The writer Nicholas Carr is joining us today to talk about the idea in his latest book, the impact of things like GPS and spell check and factory robots and self-driving cars. This book is an exploration of the human consequences of automation, a look at how it's changing not just what we do, but who we are. The book is called The Glass Cage, Automation and Us. So explain the substitution myth, if you would.
The academics and researchers and scholars, people that used to be called ergonomists and now are called human factors engineers, or have been studying automation for pretty much as long as it's been around, and particularly looking at our attitudes toward it. And what they've discovered is that we are under a general misperception, and they refer to this as the substitution myth. And what it means is that we think that we can automate some part of a job or some part of a task, one particular activity, and it will make that part more efficient or safer or whatever, but it won't change the fundamental nature of the work, of the job. And it turns out that when you automate even a small part of a job, when you hand over something from a person to a computer, for instance, you tend to change the very nature of the work, and you tend to change how people go about doing it and their attitude toward it. And so, as one researcher points out, that we rush ahead with automation, thinking that we're not going to fundamentally change people's roles and stuff. And yet, over and over again, we see all sorts of unintended effects that the designers and the users never anticipated, and yet sometimes kind of overwhelm what we expected to happen.
Mm. Well, it's like an ecosystem. Everything is connected. So as you point out in the book, if you change the weapon, you're going to change the war as well.
Right. And I think that's a good way to look at it, as this ecology of effort and attitude. And so if you move some things away from the people, some responsibilities, people begin to take those for granted. They think that the machine or the computer will handle it perfectly, and they begin to tune out in that area. And then you get some strange effects, loss of talent, loss of situational awareness. So it's not only an ecosystem, is a very complicated one that's very hard to predict what will happen before it actually happens. Mm.
You write about this small island in the Canadian Arctic, I think it is, where these Inuit hunters have really gone out into that terrain for thousands of years now, and just sort of on their own wits and their own experience and their traditions have been able to make a living for themselves. But then something changes at around the year 2000 or so. This is when they began to use GPS, and this really transforms that culture, and I think in important ways. Talk about that story, if you would.
Yeah, and so this transformation, they're in the midst of this right now.
Yeah.
It seems like the island is named Iglulik, way up in the Arctic Circle in Canada, very remote, very kind of, as you can imagine, in the winter, it's a very difficult place to get around in, yeah. And yet the Inuit. Inuits have been there for something like 4,000 years, and they've developed, as you might imagine, these extraordinary navigation skills, wayfinding skills. So even though, it's impossible to have a path because the blowing snow will cover it up immediately, and to us, there's almost no features to the land in the winter and no landmarks, they can get around very confidently and go hunting for caribou and other things. And people who have visited them for more than a century now are just amazed at the kind of skill they have in navigation, which is a skill in perception. They can kind of read the earth and the weather and the waters and stuff very closely. But then in the year 2000, the United States essentially opened up what had been a military system, the GPS system, to general use. And so GPS devices, as we all know, got cheap and very much more precise in their civilian manifestation. And of course, the Inuit began to use the devices because learning those wayfinding skills, those navigational skills, actually took a long time. There was a long apprenticeship for young people. And so suddenly suddenly saying you don't have to go through all that trial and learning process, you can just turn on your GPS. Well, it was very attractive, but what's happened is, and this is in one sense a demonstration of the substitution myth. Mm-hmm. They didn't just improve their efficiency and reduce their learning times. They started losing their way for the first time, really, in their culture. People would go out on snowmobiles with GPS machines. The GPS would fail. The batteries would freeze or would just break. And the hunters would drive their snowmobiles onto thin ice or over cliffs, things that they would never do before, suddenly they were doing because they were losing that incredibly subtle skill developed, in their culture. And to me, it's a kind of poignant story, but it's also a story about progress. And different people I've found, react to that story in very different ways. Some get a sense of loss, something important vanishing. Other people say, well, it's about time they joined the modern world. So yeah. it's an interesting kind of touchstone in a way for people's attitudes.
Well, there's this quote you use in the book from this anthropologist who says that exploration of our environment is our most fundamental way of being in the world. So it's not just First Nations people, because you write about ourselves, those of us in the lower 48 here, for example, and how we love these things. I mean, we love to see computer maps. How they're interactive these days. But you also say that we have this kind of mistaken assumption about maps. And there's this really interesting part of the book where you say a lot of us kind of think of it as, a GPS system as a high-tech version of a paper map. But it's very different. It doesn't have the same kind of context, and it doesn't give us the same sense of space.
That's right, and this comes through. There have been quite a few studies now of how people get around when they're using a GPS system, a computerized map versus a paper map. And the essential difference is that When you open up a paper map, you still have to locate yourself on the map. You still have to say, where am I, and figure it out, and you still have to then figure out how where you're going and the directions you'll have to take there, there's still an important personal navigational element. The map doesn't answer all your questions. Whereas a computerized map, GPS instructions, they don't force us to do that. They kind of, you turn it on and there you are. It locates you in space. You're on this, at this intersection. And then the map shapes itself to where you are. So you're kind of always at the center of the map. And it's not just a map. It's a computerized voice or images saying, you know, go 100 yards, turn left, go another 100 yards, turn right, destination ahead. Right. So it relieves us of having to know where we are, where we're going, how to get there. At its worst, it completely takes away our engagement with our circumstances, with our surroundings, and just gives us this kind of abstract picture of space, and then tells us how to move through this abstract picture, kind of almost implying that we aren't even real physical, real beings. We're just kind of these dots on screens. And I think that's how we begin to relate to space when we become too dependent on these tools.
Mm. What are the economic impacts? Because this is something you write about, this technological unemployment gap is, I think, how you refer to it, where you've got fewer and fewer opportunities for people kind of in that middle skill level. What's the impact of that?
So as automation has shifted from things we do with mechanical machines to things we do with computers, suddenly automation can be applied to white-collar jobs, to professional jobs. It can start doing analysis and judgment. You know, a lot of companies today, when they hire or fire people or give people raises, they follow instructions from computers rather than from professionals in their HR department or whatever. And so what we've seen in recent decades, and there's still debate among economists about exactly what the causes are, because economies are, of course, very complex.
Sure.
But what we seem to be experiencing is this erosion of all sorts of kind of good, well-paying, stable jobs. And that's been at least one of the causes of the growing polarization in income and in wealth, and what some economists at least refer to as the hollowing of the economy, by which they mean the kind of the middle class that became so vibrant and prosperous in the last century seems to be at least less populous and less prosperous and less stable.
One of the areas you explore is this dimension of machines and moral decision-making. You know, you ask this question, can a machine's algorithms, you know, calculate a decision? A decision that has these practical and these moral consequences. And in the book, you give these particular examples, generally related to driving a car. Would you sort of work us through some of those? Because I think this is really interesting when you now raise the question of whether a computer can make a moral decision.
Well, we seem to be closing in on the time when robots or robotic machines will be able to act autonomously in the world, whether that's a car that drives itself or a robotic soldier that goes to war. And when that happens, inevitably, if you have an autonomous machine acting in the world, making its own judgments, it's going to come across moral dilemmas, and it's going to have to make judgments in morally gray areas. Mm-hmm. And a simple example that I use in the book is, imagine that you're in a self-driving car, you're being driven home after work or after a party or whatever, and you're tuned out because the car is handling everything, and you get close to your house and a neighbor's pet, a dog, jumps out in front of the car. Well, the car suddenly has to make a decision. Is it going to continue on its on its path and run over the dog? Is it going to try to swerve, possibly putting you in danger, or at least putting a big dent in your car if there's a tree or something? And when you think about it, that means that those decisions, and you can think of a lot of scenarios where people, when they're driving or on a motorcycle or kind of doing anything, face difficult choices. Mm. And you have to suddenly program a computer to make these ethical decisions. And we haven't really, we're kind of pushing in that direction very quickly technologically, but we haven't spent any time thinking about the ethical dimension, because if you have to program moral decisions into a computer, you know, whose morality do you try to replicate? Who does the programming? Is it the driver? Is it the insurance company? Is it Google? Is it the government? And is it possible even to reduce all human ethical judgments to computer code? It's a very slippery slope we're getting very close to being on.
Yeah, it's interesting because you yourself raised the matter about whether machines could in fact be, in some cases, better decision makers. I mean, some say when you look at the speed at which, you know, a computer can work through options and estimate probabilities and then weigh the consequences, just on that matter alone, a machine is going to make a more rational decision than a human. So why not turn it over to a computer?
In many cases, they will, I think. And it's you know, you see people speed up to go through a yellow light, even as the yellow light turns red, right. And very dangerous, you know, very stupid thing to do, and people do it all the time. And I think it's pretty clear that a robotically driven car would never do that. But then, and so there are many scenarios, many situations where, you know, having a completely rational analysis of the situation by a computer algorithm would you know, obviate some of the stupid things or the unthinking things that people do.
Yeah.
But there are lots of decisions we make that aren't tractable in that way, that aren't reducible to this utilitarian calculation. Mm. You know, some people will hit the dog. Some people will go into a tree rather than hit the dog. And who's right?
Right.
It's very hard to say, and as I mentioned, there's you can think about it involving school buses or involving kids or involving you know, drones that are not fired in war by people sitting monitoring them at video screens, but make their own decisions about when to shoot. And in all of these areas, you can't just say this is all just a matter we're just going to reduce this purely to probabilities and calculations, because we haven't been able to do that. We know from our own lives and from philosophers that there are lots of moral decisions that are moral decisions. They're not a matter of calculation.
There's also this matter of killer robots, you know, using automation in military conflicts. And there are these ethicists you write about who are exploring the dimensions of military robots. And they've reported, you say in the book, that there are basically two ways to program a robot's computer to make moral decisions. So I wanted you to sort of take us through that just briefly, if you would. One is top-down, the other is bottom-up.
Yeah, so top-down means that you try to program all the moral decisions that a robot or a robotic soldier or whatever. You try to program every single decision they are going to possibly make. You try to say, what situations could this robot be in, and how should the robot calculate its action? That's theoretically, that's kind of nice, but as I said, there's all sorts of things that are very hard to calculate. And also, when you have a machine acting in the real world, particularly under complex situations like traffic or war, it's impossible to anticipate every single possibility, every single situation that can happen. The other way is bottom up, which means you give a little bit of basic strictures to the machine, some basic moral compass that says, you know, you don't want to kill an innocent person or whatever. And then you use what are called machine learning algorithms, right, which are recently developed ways to allow a computer to kind of refine its calculations, refine its estimation of probabilities based on experience. So it acts in the world, it takes in information about what happened, and then it refines its own algorithms, so to speak. And that too is very, very difficult, because we don't really know how to apply that to moral decisions.
Right. And there's a potential that it goes rogue. I think you said
there's a potential it goes rogue, yeah. that it learns things that go against what we do. And there's also the reality that as it's learning, it's going to do things that are horrific because it can only learn after it makes mistakes.
Right.
So human beings seem to use both of these methods. You know, we have laws in society. Our parents, when we're young, tell us you can do this and you can't do that. So that's top down. And then we learn. We face lots of different difficult situations, and we kind of learn from what we do, what makes us feel good or what has bad consequences, to develop this moral sense. And so ideally, you'd want to do something similar with computers, but computers have not advanced anywhere near far enough to actually replicate the moral learning that human beings kind of naturally go through as they go through life.
Is that coming?
I doubt it. Yeah. I mean, because some people will say it's coming.
Sure. Yeah.
But you need a self-aware, conscious robot, a self-aware, conscious computer. You know, there's a lot of people talk about things like the singularity, when computers will suddenly burst into self-awareness and consciousness and begin to be superior to us intellectually and morally. But there's a huge gap between where we are now with unconscious, inanimate computers and robots and consciousness. We don't know how consciousness emerges in our own brains, so we can't run out and program computers to do it. And so there's a lot of faith that, oh, this will happen. But my guess is we're going to find that it's certainly not going to happen as quickly as some people think, and it may never happen.
Mm. Nicholas Carr, his latest book is called The Glass Cage, Automation and Us. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the writer Nicholas Carr. We're talking about his book, The Glass Cage, Automation and Us. So I wanted to ask you about what you write about this idea, this term, automation bias, which we seem to be seeing from engineers and designers and some programmers, the idea of that we don't really need humans. We can strip out the human factor. We can build, and they love the idea. There's this conviction about that we can build this kind of self-sufficient system.
You see this attitude a lot when something goes wrong with automated systems these days. You know, a plane crashes because the pilot has lost some of his or her sharpness, and then the automation fails and the pilot makes a mistake. Fortunately, that's rare, but it is happening. Or truck drivers who are so enslaved by their GPS system that they run into low overpasses, underpasses. And one of the attitudes, and it's certainly a common one in the technology world, is that, well, this is just human error, and it shows you that we can't trust people, and people are horribly flawed. So the challenge here is not to make the automation suit the person better and make sure we reduce the possibility of human error. The best way forward is to get the human being out of the picture altogether, make perfect automated systems that don't require people, planes that fly themselves, that have no one in the cockpit, driverless cars that don't have steering wheels. And it seems to me that that's the wrong-headed approach for a couple of reasons. One is that it's actually very, very hard to get to build a perfect system because there's no such thing as a perfect, infallible technology. And so in most of these cases, even if we assume that automation and computers will continue to progress very rapidly, there's probably going to be a human element. You're going to need a person to take over if the system fails, if something breaks down, if something happens the programmers didn't foresee. So this utopian ideal gets in the way, I think, of dealing with the fact that we need to design these systems and program this software to get the best out of the human and to get the best out of the machine. And what we often call human error is often not human error. It's poorly designed automation that basically sets up the human operator, the person involved in the system, to fail because it doesn't give them enough to do, or it takes their talents for granted.
I mentioned that reference that you use in the book, later on in the book, where you point out that, you know, to resist invention is not to reject invention. The idea is to humble invention. And I wanted you to talk a little bit more about that. The idea, as you put it, is to reclaim our tools as part of ourselves. So what's the practical way that we remain humble in the scheme of all of this?
I think we start by celebrating our own talents, and realizing that, you know, we there's all sorts of things that we are very good at that we all too easily take for granted. So our ability to, through our experience in living and working and doing stuff, we have this incredible facility with figuring out how the world works, and it's often called common sense. And computers don't have common sense; they have to be programmed. And common sense allows us to do all sorts of things in all sorts of situations that we've never faced before, and do them pretty well. And then we also have an ability to think conceptually, to take the big picture, to see beyond the immediate goals or ends of what we're doing, and we can think creatively, and we can think critically. We can kind of not only do something, but think about how we might do that better. So there are all sorts of things that computers aren't able to do, valuable things that we too often take for granted. And I think what we know about the best tools, the best technologies, is that they actually don't cut us off from those types of skills, cut us off from deploying our unique distinctive abilities in the world in complex situations. They actually expand the challenges we face. They expand the horizons that we can see. And so, and you can go back to, you know, a telescope that opened up the world to us, you know, a tool that kind of allowed our eyes to see even more clearly. And so I think we can take that same ethic, that same sense that, you know, we can either create our tools to expand our talents and expand our horizons and push us further into the world and make the world more interesting, or we can use computers to cut us off from that, to say, you know, our fate is to be computer operators, people who monitor screens, who enter data into computers, who maybe take over in an emergency, things that kind of aren't interesting to do, and also things that we're not good at. So I think we can take the same philosophy that applied to tools throughout our history, whether it's, you know, the wheel or the lever, on through all sorts of other things, tools that really enrich our lives, and apply that to how we design and use sophisticated software and computer systems as well.
Mm. I want to bring it back to that Robert Frost sonnet, Mowing. It seems like what you really like about that poem is that it's the very opposite, I think you put it this way in the book, of algorithmic or computational. That in some ways, a poet's scrutiny of the world, as you put it, can be more subtle and more discerning than a scientist. And this really gets at the essence of what it's about.
There's an essay that Robert Frost wrote, which I don't talk about, but the title of it is "The Figure a Poem Makes," I think, and the figure a poem makes is very different from the figure a computer makes or the figure an algorithm makes. Writing a poem is this very delicate, but also very robust kind of way of thinking and acting that is something a human being can do, and it requires intuition, requires this kind of wittiness, this creativity, all sorts of the things that people can do, and that we, again, are very tacit skills, things that can't be programmed, that can't be reduced to calculations. And beyond the meaning of the poem, I think, you know, the poem there, creating this sonnet that follows certain rules, but is takes all sorts of, you know, kind of also allows human expressiveness to come through. Personal human expressiveness does give us a kind of metaphor for all the very, very important things that we can do, and the dangers of beginning kind of to see the world and to see life through the eyes of the programmer, through the eyes of the algorithm or the computer, where all the stress is on expediency and efficiency and things you can measure. That is important and can aid us in a lot of ways. But if we allow that to kind of push away the philosophic and experiential and poetic understanding of the world that is ours alone, then we're sacrificing something really important, it seems to me.
Mm. Less than a minute left. In the end, you said this, really the aim of all of this is joy.
If you look at the experience we can get from tools that, you know, you look at the early experience of pilots who kind of merged with their plane, merged with their technology to do something that was impossible before, you see how technology can put joy into our lives and can expand this sense of being alive and this experience of the complexity of the world. So that's always there. And if we make wise decisions, we can experience that joy with computers and with software, just as we did with planes and all sorts of other devices.
That's Nicholas Carr. He's the author of the book, The Glass Cage, Automation and Us. Nicholas Carr, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you. I very, very much enjoyed it.
Nicholas Carr joined us from KGNU in Boulder, Colorado. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Michael Shea. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.